Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Welcome to Community Matters. I'm Jane Herring. As the days get shorter, grayer, darker, and holiday promotion bops us over the head, there are many in our community who suffer from mental illness and alcohol and other drug addictions that holiday stress accentuates. Let's learn more about the relationship between holidays, winter, and heightened mental illness and addiction issues, as well as the programs that are available in our area to assist families and those who are directly suffering. Today, we're going to be talking with Guida Brown, the Executive Director of the Hope Council, and Jack Rose, who is Board President for NAMI Kenosha County, to better understand what is happening in our area and the help that is available there. So let's begin with talking about that issue of how, you know, people already have issues with addiction and with mental health. And then come the holidays, the dark. Tell me a little bit about why that really seems to affect both addictions and mental health issues. I'm not sure, Guida, Jack?
Yeah, go ahead, Guida.
Ladies, okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so the dark, as you said, and just being alone, the isolation, I think people don't like to go out as much during winter and it's cold out. And then there's the stress of the holidays. We're supposed to all get along and be on our best behavior. And all, you know, you see everything on television and everything in marketing that says what a perfect family looks like. And then you realize your family doesn't look like that, or your loved ones don't look like that. And there's just so much added stress. And if I already don't have great stress responses, then yeah, I'm going to turn to a bottle, or I'm going to, you know, just my issues are going to be exacerbated by all of that. And then I'm going to start isolating. And then I'm going to be exacerbating my issues because of that as well. Unfortunately, you add that layer of COVID to this and the social distancing and everything that has happened with that. And it's just a real slippery slope on a downhill slide.
Jack, you agree?
Oh, I couldn't have said it better, really. I'm serious. I mean, you know, we're kind of in the same business, if you may.
Yeah.
And people, you know, the isolation is not good. Many times, a holiday memory may not be real memorable for these individuals, and they may not have that family to go to. They may not have that turkey dinner, if you may. And so I think I couldn't agree more with it, the stress, the increased stressors. And that's why it's important to maintain our contact, our ties with folks that are going through maybe tough times during the holiday. So I think it's extremely important that the individuals do not go through this alone. And they can reach out. I know they can call our numbers, and we'll do the best we can to get back to them. I mean, we've had people come to the door, knock on the door on Christmas Day from the neighborhood, just trying to get that little bit of extra help. So we just have to get the word out there that folks do not have to go through this alone. Thank you.
Jack, you brought up an interesting point in that people who seek help, who recognize they need help and actually seek help, versus those who might require family or friends to intercede, versus those who, as Guida mentioned, they seek solace in the bottle and nobody sees them or recognizes they're in trouble. How many people would you say actually do recognize they have issues and take action with?
Well, I think this is a long journey, Jane, and we're all individuals and we all are going to react differently. But if you go, we have our Inner Own Voice program, and it's in five different steps. You have somebody that gives a presentation who's actually living with a mental illness. And the first step, and I'm sure Guido will agree with this, is the dark days. You know, really, they're in a bucket, whether it's living with depression, whether it's having a cocaine problem or an alcohol problem, they're in depression. And then the next step is the acceptance. And that's so important. And so you have to reach out to the people that are in the bucket. But you also have to be aware that the people that accept what they have and reach out and then try to help those people. And that leads to the third part, you know, the treatment part. And then you get on with their coping strategies. And then finally, their hopes and dreams, like with anybody else. I hope that answers that. I don't know.
Yeah. Guido?
Well, so there's a statistic that gets thrown around quite a bit that only 10% of people who need treatment access treatment. And that's a reflection on the ability to access treatment. But in fact, it's also a reflection on the ability for the person who needs treatment to recognize that they need treatment. A lot of people who need treatment are not aware that they need treatment. And then there's the aspect of what are negative consequences. In Wisconsin, our negative consequences, our floor of negative consequences are, I believe, a little higher. The floor is a little bit higher in that when in another state, maybe somebody gets an OWI, people go, wow, that's pretty bad. In Wisconsin, when you get an OWI, it's sort of like, doesn't everybody have an OWI? No, everybody does not have an OWI. And because substance use disorder, because alcohol use disorder is so prevalent here. And I'm not saying everybody in Wisconsin has alcoholism. I'm saying a lot of people in Wisconsin who use alcohol misuse it. We binge drink, we over drink, we do all sorts of things. And if I'm doing that, I'm hanging around with people who are doing that. And so the idea is that I don't really have a problem because I'm just like everybody else. So there's a misconception about what is problematic behavior. And I'm not necessarily the first one who's going to come to realize I have a problem. It's the people around me. And so we have a loved ones group where we try to get people to understand you can't fix somebody else's problem. I always use the example, my sister has diabetes, and I would never go to the nutritionist and say, tell me everything I need to know for her. I'm going to take it back. But that's what people do for us. They come and they knock on the door and they say, my child, my loved one, my husband has alcoholism. How can you help him? Where is he? In the car? Where is he? How am I supposed to help him? He's not even here. And so we talk about how can we help you to understand this and maybe to raise that bottom for that person so they have more negative consequences and come to terms with having a substance use disorder sooner rather than later.
If I may, too, on Guido's point about the family, I think that is extremely important, because many times if you have a loved one who has a mental illness, that's a very difficult time. And so we offer our family support right at the same time we offer our, whether it's adolescent or adult. But many times, my wife and I, having gone through it with both our daughter and our son, the person, the family member, may need as much help as the person living with the mental illness. And so it's extremely important. And we find, and I'm sure Guida may find the same thing with her family group, we get a lot of volunteers from NAMI for those who have gone through our family-to-family training, which is an 8-week training for family members and loved ones, not necessarily the person living with a mental illness. So it's important. It's important to get the family involved.
Is it sometimes easier? Maybe that's nothing is easy. Is it sometimes easier to coach family on how to deal with either mental illness or addictions than it is the helping cure, in quotes, the person who's affected, or helping that person live with their situation?
I don't know. You have to keep in mind, again, we're all different, but mm-hmm. having gone through it as parents, you really think you screwed up. Now, this is a long time ago. This is, you know, in, you know, like, I don't know, 1986, back in the dark ages, but you think you really screwed up. I think the help and the information is a lot more prevalent now. And I think that that is important. I really do. And so, you know, who is having a tougher time? Hard to say. But I think the fact that if we try to help both the loved ones and the person living with the mental illness, I think that that's important. I really do. Instead of just, you know, either or. If you can do it, many people that have a substance abuse issue, they may not have that family. The same thing goes with mental illness. Look at the number of homeless people. They don't necessarily have that family group connection, if you may. And so it's a complex situation. Thank you.
Guido, in your situation with alcohol and other drug abuse, often you hear that families just wash their hands of the individual. They've tried to get the person off. They just say, okay, you've just messed up one too many times. So they may not have that family support either. How do you access that person? That person has to come to you for help?
Yes, for the most part. And we don't get a ton of those calls. We get a few, mm-hmm. but again, mostly they're coming from the family. Mostly we get the call from the family saying, my loved one needs help. And the loved one isn't, and they may very well need help, but they're not ready for help. They're not interested in accessing the services. And so then we turn that to, how can we help you to come to terms with your loved one having a chronic progressive lethal disease, that you can't fix it, that you can't, you know, talk your way out of this, that you can't enable his way out of this. And so it's really about helping the loved ones figure out what they can do to take care of themselves, as well as possibly encourage some motion forward in recovery for that other person.
I'm probably going to make this more complicated than it needs to be, but both of you have talked about how important it is to have support and not to isolate yourselves. Yet, you know, understandably, some families will say, I can't deal with this anymore. You need to get help or you're not coming back home because you have a bad influence on a younger sister or, you know, you name it.
I'm sorry.
No, jump in because
on that point, you know, again, from family, having lived the experience, you want to help, you reach out, and I'll just talk to children. And they may not always be ready to listen, to hear. But one thing that's extremely important, and I think Guido will agree, is that when they are ready to talk, you need to be ready to listen. When that person reaches out for help, you must be able to help that person. And that thing goes all the way to suicide prevention. If you're dealing with somebody that is in bad shape, and you really need to be able to respond when that person reaches out and maintain that connection in trying to help him or her get the requisite help. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Instantaneously. I mean, so that's, we say, you know, when does the person need help. It's when they ask for it. And therein lies the problem. So if somebody says, I need help, and you have to wait for insurance to go through, or you have to, you know, that those are the things that cause that conflict. But making sure that we have an immediate response for people, making sure that they can access the help that is available. It might not be the help they want. It might not be the help they need at that moment, but making sure that they can access the help that is available, which is why Jack says that he gets knocks on the door during the middle of the holiday season, because that's when the help is needed. That's when people start realizing, holy cow, this is a bigger problem than I anticipated or that I thought I had.
And I think your comments are an excellent launch point now to the programs that each of your organizations provide that can help those loved ones become prepared to help those who are in trouble. So, yeah, I looked at your websites. You each have a very long list of programs, and that's great. So let's talk about some of them. Maybe Jack, begin with you with some of the programs. You've alluded to a couple, but
the core programs, if you may, they are the support groups that we have. They are the family to family groups that we have. We also have crisis intervention team training, core program for the law enforcement. The crisis intervention partners training for, it's a spinoff from the 5-day CIT training, and it's 2 days, and it's for everybody else. It can be for ER staff, it can be for mom and dad, it can be for school staff, jail staff, you name it.
It should be for everybody. A couple of our staff here at the Hope Council. No, but I mean, everyone should want to go to it. It's such a phenomenal training, especially for people who maybe don't get it. People are saying, you know, oh, he could control himself better, or this could happen, that could happen. It's such a great training. I really encourage absolutely every person to participate in that. Sorry, Jack, go ahead.
Thank you, Rita.
That was my commercial.
But it's important. And so we have these programs. And I think right now, to really tie it into the family, our crisis intervention team training, law enforcement, 5 days. We just completed a training on September 13th through 17th. And we now have 298 law enforcement trained in that. But this is a program that starts with basic education to the law enforcement. And it's interesting how you see people that start at the beginning and may not really think it's that important, but by the end, they really get it. And they do it. And I think the program is laid out in such a way that they initially start by learning about the mental illnesses and taking a little bit deeper dive. I mean, we're not making them psychiatrists, but at least they'll have an idea. They'll have an idea what some of the meds are. And again, not making them a pharmacist, but knowing what may go together. And then another key piece is to give them a good look at our local resources. Where can these people go? How can we help them out? And then you go to the end, and you talk about effective communication and trying to ease the tension that's in the room and come in it in a calm and effective manner. And at the end, we do a role play, and you have two police. They go into a scene. They're dealing with actors that we bring in, and they have a scenario. Maybe it's somebody that's intoxicated in a bar. Maybe it's somebody that's contemplating suicide in a bedroom. And so you role play it. And each role play may go 10 minutes. And then right after the training, they are debriefed on the do's and the don'ts, what they did right, what they did wrong. And this has been an extremely beneficial thing for our crisis intervention team. And you'd be amazed at how many unsolicited calls that we get where people, it's a 911, And we have instructed our dispatchers that if somebody asks for a CIT officer, they'll do their best to send one to the scene. And the feedback that we're getting, I mean, I just heard one the other day. It was incredible how the person came in, law enforcement, and just really calmed the situation. And some of these calls they get, I mean, it could really go south. And that's been a very effective program. And I think now in the current environment that we're living in, it's probably more important than ever. And I'm sorry if I got extended on that.
Not at all. No, that was that's excellent, because I think everybody realizes things are just dialed up out there. Nobody can quite exactly figure it out. You blame COVID, you blame a lot of things, but the reality is people are really cranked.
Yeah, and you can see it in Kenosha with the homicides. And a yep. large percentage of the homicides start with domestic violence. The domestic violence, I mean, if they are hunkered down in their house, you don't get out. I mean, that's it's a time bomb. It really is.
So. And you see it with the driving.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
People are nuts out there, if you don't mind me saying. Now, Guido,
we don't use the word nuts, Jane.
No, I know. No.
That's not the right term, right?
No, no.
Incorrect, Jane.
Yeah. Okay. So, Guido, tell me a little bit about your programs.
So we do assessment, information, intervention, and assessment, intervention, referral services, and education. And so people, we don't do treatment. That is a throwback to when the agency first started and we first became the assessment agency for the intoxicated driver program. A lot of the agencies, that we didn't want any perception that we were lining our own pockets by telling people they had to go to treatment, and then we offered treatment and they could come to us for treatment. So we've never done treatment at this agency, but we are a referral source. And so people will come to us. We've got great information. Again, people, when they're in crisis, they don't know what the next step is. And we've got great information on our website or through the office to say, you know, here's how you can access treatment. Here's the best model for going to treatment, you know, going, flying off to the coast and staying in a 4-star hotel with equine therapy might not be the best for your loved one because they have to come back, and what sort of resources are set up for coming back into the community. And so we make sure that people have the information that they need to know in order to make good decisions. We do have the loved ones group specific for loved ones who are affected by someone's substance use disorder, making sure that they have the tools, like I said, to figure out their own way through. You know, people talk about, like Jane, you were saying, the sort of that tough love approach. I can't deal with you anymore. I just want you out of my house, and you can't visit until you get your act together. And that doesn't work for everybody. That's not something that we would necessarily recommend. We talk about setting your boundaries and sticking to them. What little tiny boundary can you set to help that person realize that substance use is a problem? And it might be, I had the example of a woman came to loved ones group once, and she said her daughter, she had taken her daughter out to an appointment, and she usually would take her to the store afterwards and buy her groceries that she needed. So mom had gone into the bathroom, went to the bathroom, there was no toilet paper, took the daughter to the appointment, brought her home, dropped her off, said, call me, you know, tell me what happens with the appointment, and then let her go. And she came to the meeting and she said, normally I would have taken her out and bought her toilet paper and done all this other stuff. And I said, that's amazing. She said, you know, it's not about the toilet paper. I said, no, I absolutely understand. It's not about the toilet paper. It's about that one tiny little step you felt comfortable doing to set a boundary that says you need, you person with the disorder, you need to take better care of yourself. I can't fix it for you. So we really try to help people. We encourage people to figure that out for themselves. Like Jack said, it's all individualized. I can't make those decisions for you. There are people who tell their kids, you can't come in my house, but you can pitch a tent in the yard. And at least I know you're safe. I know where you are. And that works for them. I don't know that that would work for me. I can't make that determination for anybody else. So that's really sort of our number one goal, is helping people encourage their loved ones to get the help they need by figuring out what they can do to do that. Then we also have the Intoxicated Driver Program. You know, that is typically intervention through law enforcement, getting an OWI, and then being required to come to this agency if you're a resident of Kenosha County. And we work with the DA's office to do some diversion programs with them to make sure that we're not filling up our jails and prison system with people who need treatment. That's not, you know, we can't incarcerate our way out of this problem. If somebody has a disorder that is lifelong and progressive and life-threatening, putting them in jail doesn't make that disorder go away. There's no cure. And so helping them to get the help that they need. I actually just got a call today from somebody who just had his final court date for the overdose diversion program. He called and thanked us for keeping him on track. He finished the program. He's got two more days of probation, and he's so happy with his progress. And we're all just overjoyed that we made a difference in that, in even any small part. So it's the starfish story, you know, the kid here, walks here along the beach. Yeah. Picks up the starfish and made a difference for that one.
Hey, here though, because it's so true, you know, it's treatment, not incarceration. And yep. We sit on the, Kenosha County Treatment Court. Now, this is something that goes back, I don't know, 2010, something like that, where it's treatment instead of incarceration. And there are rules to follow to get in. It's about a 24-month program. And people come in and they have a felony and it's nonviolent. There are rules to get in. And so they go through a 2-year program. And as you go through the different phases, the first phase you're in, I mean, you're in the courtroom every Wednesday in front of the judge. And the committee that supports the judge, right now, Judge Jody Meyer is sitting the bench, but we have a committee that supports. So we go through and we have representation on that committee from the providers, from the DA's office, from the public defender, from the CCS, Comprehensive Community Services, part of the program that Kenosha County has. And so we see these people. And to Guida's point, I mean, the people go through this and they say, my God, thank you very much. You did save my life. And I think one other thing, and Guida mentioned it, and we have one for behavioral health too, and that's the diversion program. I think it's important if we identify people at the misdemeanor level and try to give them help at that point instead of waiting till they commit a felony. So we have both of these programs, and I think they're extremely important. And Kenosha County and Dunn County, of the two of the 72 counties, we're the only two that have treatment court that deal with co-occurring illnesses. In other words, we handle both the people with mental illness as well as the substance abuse. And so, I mean, it works, and it's something that we have here in Kenosha.
I've never heard of this before, so I'm really intrigued. What happens every Wednesday or whatever when they show up? Do people say, how are you doing?
Yeah. No. Well, you have a program that they do. They have like wraparound plans, or they get structure to their lives. They have to go to treatment. They have to go to so many meetings, possibly. They have to go and get into a program, and it's just a lot of stuff thrown on somebody that may have an addiction. They may also be living with, say, schizophrenia, depression. And so you try to organize their life and basic stuff, keeping a schedule. Many times it's important to get people to start documenting how they get through the day. And so the committee meets right before court, the judge is in there, and we go through each case, how they did during the week. Maybe they slipped, maybe they didn't slip. And then you go through, and if all goes well, they get a mark. And it tracks the individual through the process of trying to get them the requisite treatment. And I think one thing, and I'm sure Guido bear me out, we need residential places for some of these folks. I mean, just a place to live, not, you know, just like a maybe it's a room, maybe it's an apartment. And so this is important because they go through the training, but they also need a place to live. I don't know, Guido, you may want to come in on that. I mean, we have Oxford houses, we have CBRFs for the mental people living with a mental illness, but I think we need more in our community. What do you think, Guido?
I agree. And I would even say, even if it's not that sort of sustained sober living environment, we need better, more affordable housing, period, because that just has been an ongoing problem. So somebody who's newly in their recovery from either mental illness or substance use disorder may not have all the resources to do all the things they need to do. And then we throw them back into a bad environment because they have nowhere to live. And so just being able to be self-sustaining, if it is living in an Oxford house, which is an awesome program, awesome support to the community, but you know, people may not want to live. It's sort of a communal living. There are a lot of people living, a lot of adults living there together. And that's not for everyone, but being able to afford your own or moving out of there and being able to afford your own living situation is a little problematic in Kenosha. So yes, I agree. We need better options for folks who are not maybe at the top of their game.
Yes.
Well, yep. It's interesting. You said an Oxford house. Are you saying, I mean, is there something where I drive by and I see a sign saying Oxford house?
No.
I didn't think so.
It's something, it's like a national organization. It started here in like 2010. And it is a sober living house. The people that live there do drops. They do UAs. And the whole thing, they have, they're self-sustaining. They have a president, they have a vice president, they have somebody that takes care of the cooking, they have somebody that takes care of the garbage, and it is self-sustaining. Right now we have three Oxford houses in the community. One is Oxford House Ayers, which is for men. That's at 2014 45th Street. We have Oxford House Lakeside, which is at 510 60th Street. It's the old care center. It was the original site of Kenosha Hospital. The building was built in 1864. They have, maybe 9 beds there, 2-story brick, old building. And then they have Oxford House Jerry C, 2414 61st Street. And so NAMI has been helping these folks ever since they got here in 2010. And we continue to try to support them. And it can be very difficult because these are people, as Guido said, some of these folks are pretty fragile. And it's an opportunity that we really continue to try to promote in our community. And we get calls from people that have been through Oxford House. They say, thank you very much. You saved my life, period. You know, and they can work. They go there. They may be in treatment court. And it's just trying to get them through the current issues they're living with and try to get them into recovery and try to help them to become productive citizens.
Is there a certain time frame that, I'm sorry, you're out, or is it dependent on how they are progressing?
They have to maintain the rules. If you break the rules, they have a meeting at Oxford House usually once a week. You may get thrown out because you're not compliant.
But there is no, you don't have to leave at a certain amount of time.
No, there is no, there is no, no, you don't have to leave. Many people live there for a while.
And what's a while? I mean, a year, 2 years?
Couple years, maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, just to understand. I again, wasn't aware. Yeah. I think that's, it's great because you're right that some of those basic needs in trying to make sure that they're met, you know, the food, shelter.
Yeah.
We forget that some people can't even make that, especially when they're having difficulties making decisions anyway or functioning in society. So that's very helpful. We have about 5 to 6 minutes left, well, about 5 minutes left. Yeah. And I do want to talk, make sure that we've kind of covered the list of programs each of you offer, but more importantly, how do they contact you? How do you make an initial connection with each of your organizations? And I know that the answer to this, do you need money? And donations at this time are usually welcome, I'm sure.
We always accept donations. Thank you. We do. Yeah.
Yes.
Us too.
Okay.
But, yeah. You know, go ahead.
And well, and also volunteers. Now, does that require a special training on each of your parts, or do you also need, standard office type support?
We have volunteers for various different positions, and right now we're trying to get some young people into our board of directors. We have, I think we've got 12 right now, we can go to 14, and we just need people that have a passion for it because it is volunteer. And you find that as we're talking to the community, we get phone calls from people that are interested, and we say, well, if you're interested in joining the board, we have an application, and we have a regular process of getting new people into it. But you can go to namikenosha@gmail.com to get a hold of us. You can call 262-652-3606. And we have one more email is namikenosha.org.
Okay, and that's your regular website. And Gwida, how do we come and find the Hope Council?
HopeCouncil.org. Council is C-O-U-N-C-I-L. HopeCouncil.org. Great website, great information there. You can email right through the website. There's a link to contact us, info@HopeCouncil.org. But also, I would encourage people to look at the coalition website. We have a Kenosha County Substance Abuse Coalition. If anyone wants to get involved in addressing these concerns in Kenosha County, great information on that website. We meet regularly, quarterly, and have subgroups on that coalition. So that is SaveLivesKenosha.org and has just wonderful information. I'm a co-chair of the coalition. That's why I'm shilling for it. But if you're going to make donations, make them to the Hope Council.
There you go. Or NAMI Kenosha County. Or NAMI Kenosha County.
Yeah, exactly. Not to the coalition. But no, I mean, it's just for people to get involved in the cause, that is a great place to start. Lots of, and the websites, both websites are done by Westwards. They're phenomenal websites. Just a lot of great information on there for the community.
And that includes some of the programs that we really didn't have time to delve into today. I have to say, you both just really amaze me because talking about all the different programs that each of your organizations have, plus you both sit on the treatment court
for once a week and have meetings before?
No, I don't. Sorry.
You don't. Okay.
I don't want anyone to think I'm taking credit for that. I would love to, but I don't.
Well, okay. So just Jack then.
Yes.
But yeah. It just amazes me really that all that you accomplish or try to do to help everybody, you're doing good work. So really appreciate information that you have shared with us today. We've been talking with Jack Rose, president of the board for NAMI Kenosha County, and Guida Brown, executive director of the Hope Council. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Jane Herring.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
The Thanksgiving Waltz by Jay Unger, played by violinist Jay Unger and guitarist Molly Mason, a request from Ed and Bailey's Harbor, as we look forward to Thanksgiving this coming Thursday. In fact, this is a very popular CD, Harvest Home, music for all seasons with Jay Unger and Molly Mason. Lori Skelton was telling me yesterday when I was trying to locate the CD that Anders Yoakum has this scheduled for tomorrow on the Sunday brunch. And apparently Stephanie Elkins has it also sometime coming, perhaps even Thanksgiving Day. She'll be playing quite a bit from this CD as well. Well, we've just completed the first 2 hours of Classics by Request. Thank you to the listeners who shared their requests with us in these last 2 hours, and to Linda and Plover for the Lark Ascending. We have 1 hour remaining after the latest news from NPR, and then our third and final hour. at 1 o'clock. I invite you to join me for 3 hours of Saturday afternoon classics and looking at the playlist. There'll be some music, one of the string quartets of Haydn in the first hour and Debussy's La Mer. Also in the second hour, we'll hear the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Peter Tchaikovsky and a sonata for bassoon and cello by Mozart. And in the third and final hour, a flute concertino by Cécile Chaminade, and one of the partitas by Johann Sebastian Bach, among other works sprinkled in between. So if you are free for that, for this afternoon, anytime, tune in between 1 and 3 o'clock for Saturday Afternoon Classics.
Every Sunday evening, Simply Folk brings you 3 hours of great folk music, from string bands to bluegrass, Celtic, American.